Hello everyone and welcome back to the Computer Vision in Production podcast show. The podcast show where we talk all about everything computer vision, from the individual components of the technology including vision, cameras and deep learning, right through to hearing about some of the most interesting applications that companies are using at the moment. Hello everyone and welcome to the Computer Vision in Production podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Kelly. Today's guest is Justin Schenk. Justin is the co-founder and CTO of Berlin-based startup Visiolab. Justin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
Great. Really, really happy to have you here. Second time podcast guest. Already spoken at my meetup. You know, I'm really excited to get you on the new podcast show, which is dedicated all around computer vision because it's at the core of what you are working on at Visiolab.
Definitely. Yeah. At Visiolab, we're an AI software company in Berlin. We're focused on building computer vision software for mobile devices for recognition of food and canteens. And we also have offices in Osnabrück. And there's, yeah, a lot to talk about. So glad to be here again.
Excellent. Nice. Cool. So look, quite compared to many guests I have, I know a lot about you. I know a lot about what you've done, your background, how you moved into computer vision. But I suppose, look, rather than it come from me, Justin, why don't you set the scene? Tell us a little bit about you and what got you into computer vision.
Sure. So my background is neuroscience research. In the US, I was studying biology and the brain. And one of the tasks that we were looking at was trying to understand how the brain is able to do things like speech or motor control, how these things are processed in the brain. And we were doing lots of experiments, collecting data, and often the challenge came up of how can you automate this process of sifting and sorting through lots of images. So this process of kind of manually looking at images and manually labeling them and cleaning the data got me thinking, oh, it would be great if this could be automated. So I think it's a common story from a lot of neuroscientists who turn into the data science direction or computer vision is you start off with a task that's like a grad student level task and you ask yourself, wow, how can I do this faster? And machine learning is a really interesting field. It's been there for a long time for people who are looking to automate processes and data. And with deep learning, you're able to automate a lot of visual recognition and also finding patterns in images that wasn't possible years before. So it's been really exciting moving from that space, from the science space to the tech side and being able to bring some of that curiosity and asking questions to now building new products that leverage the new technology on mobile devices.
So look, that takes us up to you, your background. Where did Visiolab come from then? You know, when did you start? What was the initial concept? And I suppose, where are you now?
Sure. So I met my co-founder, Tim Niekamp, in Osnabrück, which is a city in Germany, on the way to Amsterdam, if you're coming from Berlin. It's a place where I was studying cognitive science with a focus on machine learning and computer vision. And he was, at that time, when I met him, starting Visiolab in 2019, the summer. And he had worked for the previous payment provider for German canteens, the largest one called Intercard. He worked for the parent company for that. And he had started down the path of building a venture case and getting angel investors. And at the same time, I was looking into building a mobile app for visual recognition of food and calorie estimation for a hospital in Canada. So super random. And we were both at the Seed House, which is a startup accelerator in Osnabrück. And I heard, hey, have you met this Tim guy? He's also working on food recognition. And really surprising considering it's such a small town from the tech scene that we would have similar projects. So we met and we were able to do more and build a bigger company and raise more funds. And we had a similar vision for what kind of company we wanted to build. So it was really, yeah, serendipitous. And that's how it started.
Yeah, pretty, like, I mean, to put it into context, to find someone doing food recognition in Ottenbrook is pretty insane, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's like, it turns out there's a focus on food in the area, which like in hindsight makes sense. It's a very like agricultural area in right. Niedersachsen and Lower Saxony. But yeah, I would say I would not have been able to plan a better chance meeting like that. I was just worked out.
Look, let's talk about Physiolab and your product. So it's, as you say, it's a mobile app that will allow you to recognize visually what food's in front of you. Is that just from a very simple case of a canteen, what's on a food tray, or where does it end in that sense?
Exactly. So in a canteen or a cafeteria or a food hall, you often have this situation where you take the food from the servers and then you put it on your tray and you go to the checkout line to check out. And the process that we're building is something that can recognize the food on your tray in a way that supports what the cashier is doing, or can augment it so that they can do more checkouts at once. So this process being increased speed and increased accuracy is something that we see that the customers that we've spoken with in Germany and in Europe would really like. So a lot of the big canteens are looking at this and saying, okay, how do we improve the scalability of our checkouts so that we can, you know, put up 8 checkout units at once in a large cafeteria or mess hall, for example.
Yeah.
So there's a demand for that. And also we've seen even in the past few years, like in Japan, maybe you've heard about this meme going around that there was a Japanese AI company that was recognizing baked goods for bakeries. And so people would put their brochen or their buns on the table and the camera would recognize it so they could do a fast checkout. And the meme was sharing how they've turned their technology to work on cancer cells and were able to detect other types of things with it. It was also useful. So there's probably much wider markets even than the ones we're starting on.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, because I actually know of a German Munich-based business called Preci Bake, and they do something quite similar, but I actually think they check the buns in the oven. Again, it's not exactly the same, but it's not too far off, right? They're visually looking at the bun to get the perfect bakedness of it, if bakedness is an actual word of it.
Yeah, I can wish that I have something like that when I'm baking. I'm not the best baker. I usually overcooking or undercooking my cookies.
Yeah, I'm on the road of I don't think I've had a non-sticky middle in a banana bread yet that I've had to recook, cut it into slices and recook them individually.
Yeah, wait till there's AI for that. Just like sticks the fork in for you.
Yeah. Cool. So look, tell us about how you started Physiolab. And I mean, from a product side in everything, I mean, so I'm talking gathering data. Where did that even begin? Because I mean, I guess there's no, unless I'm wrong, is there public data sets of food from canteens, or where did you start really?
Yeah, that's a good question. So often in AI, it's a race to get the biggest and best data set, because that is going to push your accuracy up. So there are public data sets that are available. So Food 101 is a common example. And some of the data sets are only for research purposes. Other data sets are there to basically test out and see how it works. But what we have is a combination. So we have data from the canteens that we've worked with, which was really useful for bootstrapping our models in the beginning and getting kind of like our baseline accuracy. But we also are focused on techniques for few shot classification. So that means that we invest more into building the tech that lets us recognize food with one or two or three images. So we don't need the huge data set behind it. That's one of our strategic focuses. And we think that's also something that gives a lot of value to our customers. So they don't have to set up and run our data collection for several months before we can do something valuable for them.
I know I'm quite familiar with the term few-shot learning, and I suppose the concepts behind it. But But I do also, you know, you hear a lot of people saying how difficult it is, how hard it is to productionize. You know, where does that come in for you? You know, surely it's not so simple of, hey, look, I've got two pictures of, I don't know, beans on a plate. Is it like, where does it go to train it from there? What's the challenges? Of course we know the benefits, but let's talk about the ugly stuff first. What was hard about it?
Yeah, the hard part definitely lies on a few different dimensions. So on one side, you've got the operations where maybe the customer has not used to thinking about visual food recognition, automated food recognition. So maybe they have in their menu two types of beans served in the same day that look identical. One has pork and the other doesn't, but they're charged this, you know, different prices. And in that operational dimension, we help to make sure the customer is AI ready and to help them to either rearrange their menus so the way the foods are distinctly looking for that day, or we kind of coach them on what can you do to increase the accuracy so that it works with their current setup. And then on the technical side, the technical challenge that we're facing is mainly to have a fast turnaround from the user showing one image of that bowl of beans to being able to recognize that. So there are some techniques that are useful in this direction. And like from active learning is one that you might have heard, that you can just update the model right away. But we want to combine that with the ability to monitor the success of the model. So we include a lot of features in the back end that make it stable and robust, so that way we can take in images and we can also make sure that whatever we learn from the customer side goes to improve the models, and then those models can be deployed directly back to the device. So we do minimal kind of computation for training the models on the device, but we do all the inference on the device. And splitting the task this way lets us focus on, okay, we don't need to do the heavy lifting on the iPad, which is running there in the cafeteria, but we can have that heavy lifting being done in the cloud.
I know it's not so relevant because you wouldn't be comparing these types of images, but you ever see I'm sure you've seen the one online where it's the machine learning algorithm can't tell the difference between a Chihuahua dog and a cupcake.
Yes. That's an important one to be able to tell the difference between.
Yeah, and there's also, what's the other one? Is it a ginger cat and a croissant?
Yeah, cat croissant. Yeah, that's true. Yes, it's getting, animals are getting dangerously close to looking like food items.
So. But look, with that, obviously you can see the challenges of how important it is to have how accurate the menu is going to be, and how accurate. Look, if you're going to have that one or two piece of data, how accurate that's going to be. Yeah. Does it have to be, I know it's again a very tough question, is there a perfect image? If you're going to train it on one image, is there a perfect image?
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually. So yeah, it would be amazing if you could guess when you see an image how well this image is first distinct from other things that have been seen before. So in other words, how challenging would this be, or how similar is it? Like, if it too much overlaps with other things, then you would say, oh, you know, this might be a challenge for us. And then you could prompt the user to say, oh, actually, you know, not just one image, but let's do three just to be safe. This is actually a really good question. It's quite a challenge, and it's something that we're looking to implement on the edge, which this part actually really excites me, because it's less of the, like, it's less well known how this technology works. And it's also more on the researchy side. So you have more challenges that are not already solved out there. So you don't have an out of the box solution for this that can help you. And this is something that's also quite useful for us, because we are prompting the user then, okay, take some more pictures. So yeah, if you do have some measurements, some kind of metric that tells you how good is this image, how likely am I to be able to detect images like this, then that can be very useful for guiding the user to take the appropriate number of images. So yeah, really good question.
I guess it's going to be project specific, but do you ever come into a situation and say, look, few shot learning versus active learning, you know, both are focused on training or building a model on limited data. How do you compare these, or how do you feel, I suppose, which one is going to have more success, or is it, again, is it challenge specific?
All of these components are useful to keep in mind and be able to tailor them for a specific project. So it's hard to tell when you're starting on a project what exactly is going to be useful or necessary until you can look at the data. I think this is one thing that my co-founder did really well in the beginning days, is he started collecting data from the very beginning. And that's so useful when you're doing an AI project to have an idea how well does the data that I'm looking at represent the problem that I want to solve. And if you get an idea, okay, I'm going to have to be able to recognize things on the fly, then you might start thinking about few-shot learning. Yeah. And if you think, oh, well, I might be able to get some feedback from the user and use that feedback to improve the accuracy, then you might want to start thinking about active learning. And it just happened that both of those were relevant for us.
Moving on to something you've actually just said there about, you know, and edge devices. I'm always quite curious to understand what your first sort of concept of the product looked like. You know, I hear a lot of cases where people are like, oh, it was a Raspberry Pi, or it was something we built into an iPhone, and it was just a really clunky piece of kit. What was that like for you? What was your, I suppose, your ugly prototype?
Oh, well, yeah, we definitely started with some ugly prototypes. It's funny, in this field, there's quite a few competitors in Europe and Germany specifically, and they're all starting with big hardware systems. So like, I think that if you were a designer, like an industrial designer, you might be able to come up with something that looks really nice and fits in really well. I don't happen to have that skill. So, but you know, we had something good to start with, something that was working with a Raspberry Pi. And what we learned early on was that getting a device out there that people want to buy and that scales is kind of it's the most important thing, right? You want something that people want to have and put on their shelf. And I think that our competitors are finding really interesting ways to deliver similar types of products. But I think our approach, by focusing on the software and choosing an iPad, which has already been designed to perfection for its use cases, has been a really good choice for us so far. And I think like it could be really fun to come up with ways to package it better. But at the end of the day, the trust from the customer is the most valuable thing. So to like in that context, you won't be more trustworthy than Apple in terms of the hardware that you can deliver. So that's a pretty good bet.
A good place to stake. All right. Yeah. I also imagine when you say you're like industrial companies, I imagine they're building up these big, huge pieces of kit that, you know, are going to cost 15, 20, 30,000 for one machine. And, you know, if you go down the road of iPads with maybe like a subscription for your software, it's a lot more realistic for most companies to even consider it, right?
Yeah, for sure. Going down the road, I think it's likely that iPad will keep the technological advantage that we need for our use case. And if you think 5 or 10 years down the road, then it's another ball game, but it's very likely that we're picking a kind of wave to ride on top of. And yeah, it's worth figuring out which horse you're betting on and then double your bet once you've chosen it.
Yeah. Also look, I'm not too familiar with it, but I imagine like these canteens, I imagine the profit margins aren't absolutely massive. So again, to tell them, hey, look, you've got an iPad solution going to cost, you know, dramatically less as to what, you know, get this full piece of kit in. They're going to do the same thing and, you know, provide the exact same service, what one are you going to go with? They're also probably a lot less afraid of looking at an iPad as opposed to something that they see, oh my God, this is an AI monster. It's going to come in here and take our jobs. Whereas people are familiar with iPads, right? They know what they do. You don't have to go on that whole digital transformation process with them.
That's true. And I think it's also more likely that we'll find ways to help the staff there or to help whatever customers' needs might come up if we're on a flexible product. And at the moment, you don't get more flexible than a tablet.
Yeah. So I suppose just we've talked about, you know, a few shot learning. We've talked about your ugly prototypes and where you are now. So I want to talk about, you know, going from concept into production. You know, I suppose, look, from an essence, you have this data, you have this model, you want to make a product. In between, there's lots of different steps. What's the most difficult part to take something from research into production in an AI world?
Going from research to production is quite a challenge because research is and can be very broad and you can go infinitely deep. So aligning the needs for the production case with the sort of range of applications or a range of possible directions and research is, I think, a big challenge there. So it helps if you have experience already implementing something in research into a production environment. A few years ago, I mean, one of the big challenges for companies going into production in AI was simply take this paper, a YOLO paper or a ResNet paper, and then implemented in TensorFlow or PyTorch. So I know a few guys who were working on these kinds of applications and their job was to take the research paper and to be able to code it in Python. So those kind of challenges are still there. Maybe some of the things are more specific, but yeah, I think if in computer vision a few years ago, it was going from 0 to 1, you really had to build a lot of the infrastructure yourself. Now, a lot of that infrastructure is there. So the research is useful when you are coming up with new applications or trying to increase the accuracy another 1%. Or if you want to just simply see like, hey, what can we do with this new technology, with this new NLP model with BERT, for example? It's really interesting to find, for example, a master's thesis student who's working on language embeddings for food recognition, because then you can find a relationship between how does the food look and how does the AI model see the food versus how does an AI model see the food in terms of text. And you can find relationships between the name of the food and the image of the food. So there's lots of really neat things you can do still. Getting into production is mainly a matter of showing the value to the business, showing the value to the customer. And once that's established, then yeah, there's more opportunities opening up behind it.
Good. No, that's good. I mean, look, I think as well, less of a problem these days because of advancements in technologies, better computing power, better camera systems. But, you know, a lot of research would have been quite conceptual that would have actually never been able to hit production level, you know, and that's, I suppose there's an element of having to be realistic there, right? And that's where it's, yeah, do you know what? Would you recommend if you have something, try to productionize it quick? Or is there any sort of other advice you would give to anyone who has something and they want to know, hey, I think I've got a great idea, I've got a great possible product, I need to know if this works?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, validating the customer benefit is probably the limiting factor for a lot of projects. And if you can even just make a set of PowerPoint slides saying, here's what I think the customer benefit is for this product, here's how they could use it, here's how we could monetize that. And when you start from the end and work backwards, then you can justify, okay, it actually makes sense to really try this approach with this data and see what your results will be, because you don't want to spend months experimenting with something and find out it doesn't work the first time or the second time. And then maybe even by the end, when it does work, it doesn't have as good accuracy as you expect. and then still not have the customer benefit demonstrated. So it's much better to start with being clear that, okay, our users could improve this and that. Here's a new feature that we can provide. Here's the value add for this new feature. But here's the time window we're going to have to experiment on and to figure out. So yeah, that's definitely a challenge for companies who aren't used to estimating projects like this. And it applies equally to data science projects. It's not obvious how to value time of a data scientist when the outcome is not clearly defined.
So some aspects that, you know, jump up about the VisioLab product, you know, use are fairly much machine learning in the wild, right? Use don't have physical control over the edge device that your algorithm runs on. How do you manage that?
That's a good question. So currently we are relying on a lot of software for monitoring and logging the results and the uptime of the services that we're providing. You can get situations where some data gets in there that's unexpected. So someone, you know, puts their hand over a piece of food on accident, and now you've got a piece of their hand in your data set. And those cases we want to be able to catch as early as possible. If we're not catching it on the device, we still have a place where data could go to be checked through. And that's the kind of way to make sure your quality of your data is good. And there are some automated ways to make it easier too. So once the data is in the cloud, we can run some algorithms over that data to identify, okay, here's an anomaly. Here's something unexpected. It looks like this doesn't look like a normal piece of broccoli, even though we classified it as broccoli. And when you do that, you can guarantee the quality of the data before it goes into the model and before those models get deployed back to the device. So it's a combination of figuring out how much human in the loop you need and how much you can automate and make everyone's lives easier through automation in the back end.
Nice. And out of interest, how do you catch people who are trying to get a free lunch?
Good question. So free lunch, there is no free lunch is what I've heard. I would say if we work with our current partners and we find out exactly what's the comfort zone for them and find out, okay, you know, your average theft rate is whatever percent. Here's what the theft rate would be with this product. Then we figure out, okay, if there's a critical difference in that, we can suggest remedies. We can suggest ways to have cashiers to have more oversight over the process. There's a lot we can do on the tech side as well. So automatically recognizing, you know, hey, this looks like it's at a different elevation, like different height. So it's possible that something is stacked underneath it by maybe by mistake. But yeah, at the end of the day, it's a valid question. Who's accountable? So if you have a pilot flying a ship, you want to know that the pilot is in control. And in our case, we are trusting that the cashiers and the staff, the boss for the canteen is the one in control. And our job is to make sure that they're able to do their job properly. And in doing that, we're totally open and help people figure out what are the limitations for the device. And yeah, often it comes down to just being clear with the expectations and saying, okay, the customers are expected to separate the food properly on the tray. You know, obviously don't put your hand over the food. And if these expectations are met, then on both sides, we're both happy that the data will be good and we'll be able to give them the best service possible.
I suppose something that I wanted to ask, it's actually related to what you are doing, but not directly related to VisioLabs. And it's just your software looks like it could obviously be used in many other domains, right? You know, and particularly we look at, let's say, Amazon Go, super popular, super hype. In my opinion, not very realistic because, you know, not everyone's going to want to sign up. I'm quite skeptical of the fact that, you know, I sign up to Amazon Go and there's not some guy in Scotland who looks very much like me, sets up an account and, hey, they charge me, right? I think there's some flaws in that. But what I don't think there's flaws in is self-service checkouts, quite similar to what you do in canteens for grocery shopping. Is that something you ever considered?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. For grocery stores, there's lots of opportunity to improve operations and to make life more convenient. I mean, from my point of view, I also like the idea of Amazon Go, that why should I have to think about what I'm paying for and just have it automatically be charged to me? But it's not practical in its current form and it's too expensive. So in grocery stores that want to add visual checkout to their checkouts, we can increase the speed there. That's a good point. So there's a possibility, for example, if you put a fruit there, why should you have to tap 5 different screens until you find that fruit? And I like to travel. So when I'm traveling and I'm having to learn a new language, you know, to find out the German name for ginger is Ingwer would take me, you know, probably too long and could clog up the queue. So, but if there was a visual recognition of that on the checkout stand, then you could speed up the checkout. I mean, I think we haven't done strict calculations on it, but we expect that we could speed up quite a bit in the food and produce direction. Fruit and produce.
I even mean that as well. Like, you know, you look at it, if you buy multiple of the same item at the self-service checkout, which I go to a lot of the time, because I buy groceries for two people, not necessarily have to go to the big ones. But if you're buying multiple of the same items, you have to individually scan them. It just seems to be quite... Look, they were amazing when they first came out, but now I'm like, man, they're quite labor intense. you've just become so your expectations have changed quite so much, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a pity that you can't just put the 4 items that you got on the table at once and recognize that.
Yeah, but it's something. If it was ever to go on steroids, is like you could have like a trolley and it would just scan your trolley and tell you everything that's in it, you know, straight out to the car then, right?
That's really cool. Yeah, when you come to Berlin, you should check out the one at Reva. There's one that's doing one of these proof of concept things there. So I'm also curious. I haven't used it myself yet.
That's really cool. I do often think, and I'm not ever to say that it's to replace workers. In my opinion, when you go to Aldi's and Lidl's, I know they have their measures, you know, they hit a buzzer to get someone to come to the till. But I mean, they could use with some helpful staff on the floor, right? I'm either they're in the back or they're on the tills. I don't even think they have floor staff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting point. Yeah, it could be so much easier, I think. But I wonder if it's going to get harder before it gets easier for the staff. I mean, if we're developing new technology, you always need help from people that are experiencing it firsthand. Yeah. And so this process of learning what technology works the best sometimes can be a pain. But yeah, ideally in the end, it's a smooth transaction, and that could be the most convenient for everyone.
That's great. And I agree, Justin, I totally agree. But I mean, for us, that takes us up to the end of this episode. So for everyone listening, this is the Computer Vision in Production podcast show. I'm your host, Anthony Kelly. Today's guest was Justin Schenk, the co-founder and CTO at Berlin startup Visio Labs. Be sure to check them out. And Justin, it was fantastic to have you on the podcast show again. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure as well, Anthony. Thanks a lot.
Listening to this episode of the Computer Vision in Production podcast with your host, Anthony Kelly. To make sure you get updates on the latest episodes of the show, make sure you subscribe on your preferred podcast listening app or add me on LinkedIn.